Well, lo and behold, there you are. I was hoping you would show up today because there's not much point in me being here if you are not there, if you get the drift of the message. My name is Ray Hill. The name of the show is Ray on the Radio, and we spell R-A-Y-D-I-O just because we do other things that are funny and strange, too. And I'm in here every Wednesday afternoon from about 2 o'clock and till 3 o'clock, and we flip all these switches on and get the equipment exercised. They tell me that we've got a new phone providing service in the studio, which should clarify some previous static problems that someone else perceived. It was working fine for me, but if you'll call in, 713-222-0715 is that magic number, and feel free to call in anytime during the course of the show. I was supposed to have a guest, but I may have been stood up again. That's not the first time in my life that has happened. So if a guest shows up, we'll play with the radio with the guest. It's a play. If the guest doesn't show up, it's you and me left to play with the radio, but you can only play with it if you call 713-222-0715. It is Wednesday, which meant yesterday was a Tuesday. There's a hot election going on in beautiful, historic old Alabama, and my guest just showed up late and not properly dressed for the party, but that's all right. It's radio, so who knows? And so we'll talk. And have a seat, whoever you are, and put on some headphones and the microphone. I'll turn on when the appropriate time comes. This is Houston Media Source, and we have a little studio in here which we produce radio. I am about the only live show on the air. We have other programming, a lot of robo music selected by radio wizard Ronnie Renfro, who's been a radio almost as long as I have, but since he's not as old I am, not quite as long as I have. And then we occasionally have other programmers come here and do pre-produced shows. And we're expanding to have a sound studio located next door to this studio so that we can increase production potential for you. And you can participate in that. We are Houston Media Source. We were once called Houston Access Cable. And that means that we've got an open door over here and we've got studio equipment. I've got a television station. And you can come learn to use the equipment. And you can take advantage of your ability to use that equipment to produce the media that you think is important to produce. Well, this show is my show. And why I think it is important, it gives me a vehicle to come here and talk about generally just about anything I want to. The station treats me like he treats everybody else, and that is we are content neutral at Houston Media Source, as long as you don't get us in trouble by using dirty words and don't go too far out on some ideas that are offensive to others. But generally speaking, we don't censor people on these airwaves. And so, get up close to the microphone. You've taken off your hat so it's not going to bite you. And introduce yourself.
My name is Pastor George.
Pastor George, glad to have you. And I see Roger is bringing you some liquid nourishment. Thank you, Roger. It's very kind of you.
I like Roger, by the way.
Well, he's very easy on the eyes, actually.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. People can't see that in radio, but and he's handy as a glove. He does most of our training here. He teaches people how to use cameras and studios.
Yeah.
He's good. Yeah. He's a filmmaker of good weather on his own.
Well, he brought me a drink.
That's right. He brought you some water. Sorry, there's not something else in it, but that's the way it goes. I'm glad you came, Pastor, because I just kind of...
You're F.U. Pastor George.
Okay, F.U. Pastor George. I'm kind of concerned about what is going on in Alabama.
Well, my buddy Roy Moore has been telling it as it is. He says the queers should be abolished, should be decriminalized.
You know, they're not talking a lot about that.
No.
They're talking about old guys chasing young girls right now.
Yeah, well, we've all done that. Now, I'll just be frank with you. Anybody who hadn't done what, you know, and done it in front of a girl, they ought to be over 14, though. But anyway, that's what men are. I call it like it is, Ray. You know, Pastor George doesn't mince words. Well, Pastor George realizes.
Well, you know,
I'm sorry.
I have to admit. But I, in my dotage, I don't spend a lot of time in the malls. But I understand that there is a lot of kids that go there to the malls. It's kind of a gathering place for youngsters.
Yeah.
And I don't go to a lot of high school football games. First place, I don't care much about football, and high school games are the kind of the low end of that ebb, but
I understand you were a football player.
I was at one time.
You
in the
put
last
your hands down under someone's ass.
Yeah, right.
Every time, that's why you wanted to be the
you
quarterback.
You have to do that to get the ball.
Yeah, well, you were reaching for two of them at the same time. That's your problem. But we know that.
A skipper never complained about that, as long as we won the game.
Well, the center certainly did because
that's Skipper.
He got one ball ripped off one time because you were rough with him.
That's Skipper.
You know, that's no good.
And right? you know,
it was his right one too.
We've got to give the audience here an image of Skipper bent over being the center.
Yeah.
And if you've got a love seat in your house, you know, one of those couches with two cushions in the back, that's what Skipper's back end looked like. It looked like those two cushions on a love seat. So actually, the safest place on that field was in the crack of Skipper's behind, because the opposing team had to get a visa to come all the way around back there and rough me up.
You're about to crack me up.
Well, you got to do a visual. If you're a radio, you can't do a visual.
Just do a visual.
Well, tell me what? Yeah. How are serious Alabamians? Is that what you call them?
Alabamians. Yeah.
What do they think about what's going on?
They're divided, Ray. I'll be quite frank with you. A lot of people falling off. Roy Moore, my buddy. You know, he and I have a thing going too.
Really?
I mean,
you both practiced a little law.
Well, I'm a pastor.
I know, but
he was a district.
But you
attorney.
Have a background. And
yeah. Well, my lawyer does. Walter Boyd. Do you know him? Yeah.
He's been a lawyer,
but. I've just been a pastor.
Well, you know,
preacher. You're FU Pastor George.
Well,
don't ask me what FU stands for.
I understand that.
Am I too loud, Ray?
No, you're doing fine. I can modulate you anyway. I got limited.
You're going to do what to me?
I can modulate
you. Listen,
with
that's
my...
what you did to that center, and I don't need any modulation. Okay.
Well, let me tell you,
I'm strong enough to carry an extra ball in Alabama.
Roy Moore got kicked off the bench twice?
Twice.
What was that all about?
Well, for putting that Ten Commandments statute three ton in the Supreme Court building to begin with many years ago. And then recently he issues an edict to tell the probate judges not to issue any marriage licenses and not to follow the law.
Do marriages in probate courts in Alabama?
No. Well, they're the am I talking too gruff or what? I'm losing my voice because I had a little bad thing last night.
Okay,
No, probate judges, it's just a matter that here the county clerks issue the marriage license. Over there, the probate judges do. It's just a matter of form. It's whatever they want
okay,
to do.
Okay, well, you know, if the probate judges are the licensee, it would indicate that Alabama puts the emphasis on the civil benefits of marriage, because probates deal with wills and codicils and things like that.
I don't know, Ray. My lawyer, Walter Boyd, he should be here, but I guess he fell by the wayside. He drinks a little too much, too, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And so he may have.
I've known lawyers that did that.
Yeah, well, he's pretty bad about it, and that's why. But I'm his pastor, and I try to pastor him. But I must admit.
Well, the work of a pastor is not easy work.
It's terribly difficult work, Ray. Can I call you Ray, you
please,
queer?
Please do.
All right. Well, please, you know, I'm not pleased with your sexual.
Well, I don't care what you think about me, but the deal is that we're communicating about issues.
Yeah. Well, they issue the marriage licenses, okay. And so there's some, like, I don't know, 48 counties or maybe more or less. I've forgotten. But in about one-third of them now, maybe the probate judges have refused to issue marriage licenses. The reason they refused to, because of the Oglefeld decision. Now, my lawyer, Walter Boyd, here.
I know that.
I'm your FU
pastor. That was actually a divorce. That was actually a probate case. It was.
Yeah.
Somebody had died, and the issue was: do you recognize their spouse of many years as a wedding partner?
Yeah. Well, he issued it because the probate judges were faced with the problem that they issued marriage license. They'd have to issue a marriage license to queers like you if you want to get married. You're not going to get married again, are you?
No, I don't. At my age. It would be a waste of the other person's time.
Well, the only reason you should marry is for money anyway. That's my position, if you're a man.
Well, that's an interesting position taking in pastoral counseling.
What kind of counseling?
Pastoral.
Oh, pastoral. Yeah. That's true. But remember what the great St. Paul said about women. Don't mess around with them. Don't F with them. If you got to do it, and you just get so worked up and lustful, you go on and get married, but don't marry him. And that
don't
was the
be
best
beating on the table.
Oh, my gosh.
That sounds like Rush Limbaugh. Beating on the table. He always beats on the table. Drives people crazy all over the country.
Well, I won't beat on the table, but you better not beat on anything.
You can slap your leg, but don't beat on the table.
I won't beat on the table. I'm your FU Pastor George.
Yes, sir.
I usually get my way.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I understand.
Of course, I'm
under
your influence.
Radio studios are a little different from pulpits.
Now, who have we got on the line?
We don't have anybody on the line. I could give out the telephone number again. If you want to talk to me or Pastor George or any of his alter egos, the telephone number is 713-222-0715. Now, I don't require that you call in, but if you call in, we'll have a good time playing with the radio, just the three of us here.
I wish you'd play with the radio and play with yourself.
713-222-0715. That's Houston, which is the area code of Houston, 713-222, which is the downtown exchange.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like really downtown, 222-0715. The water's pretty good.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I get carried away with myself, you know.
But
I'm your FU Pastor George.
Now, Georgia, I take it, is not quite. What's the deal between Georgia and the Democrats? What does Georgia have against generic Democrats? Alabama.
Well, they used to be an all-Democratic state.
I remember that.
20 years ago now, with this race against my buddy Moore, he did back in his 30s. You know, he fooled around with 14-year-old girls, and he might not should have done that. The main one was a 16-year-old girl. Who she's come out now, and she's just crying all over TV. He did this to me. Well, look.
Well, I mean, 40 years is a long time to cry.
I know, but she got a hold of Gloria Allred, you know, and Gloria has made all she can do against my buddy Moore. Hey, listen, I'm telling you, I just call him my buddy, but anybody that gets caught. See, Pat, I like that. He should watch it. I don't know what he could have done, but my goodness.
Well, it doesn't make a difference what he could have done. It's what can he do now?
Yeah,
you know, the thing about it is that people get all excited about the news. Well, it's not really news if it happened 40 years ago. And I sat there and I watched the video of that complaining witness, and I couldn't see a 16-year-old girl. I saw a mid-50s woman. And it's hard to get the impact of her message when you can't visualize what she was when she's talking about it.
Well, I don't know either, but I do know this, Ray. My lawyer, Walter Boyd, has suggested that he wants the age of consent lowered to 14. Because
these
14-year-old girls, 15-year-old girls, they've had more sex under their belt than my three or four grandmothers. Your three or four grandmothers. How many grandmothers you have?
I don't have any right now. I'm fresh out of grannies.
But anyway, and that's just the fact of the matter, and that's even worse. There's so much sex going on in these schools. Have you seen it?
No.
I've seen it. My lawyer, Walter Boyd, he told me to mention his name as many times as I could.
Well, I understand that. Lawyers are like that.
And he said... owed him a bit of money, but he owes me a bit of money as his pastor. I've had to help him a lot, and also other lawyers. I was Jim Skelton's pastor, and Jim Skelton just blew me away. He didn't care. He said it's all a bunch of nonsense and this religion business. But Walter Boyd, the lawyer, by the way, should I give his phone number out?
No,
he doesn't have a phone number because he didn't pay his bill.
Okay, but you brought up Jim Skelton, who's a special person to me. And Jim and I did a good bit of good radio and a little television together. And talking to Jim was an experience. He knew to... put on the pretense of being one of the gods on a mountain overlooking Pergamum and describing the world from there, except he did it with kind of a Western twang and a goat roper's attitude, which I thought was a wonderful exercise in humility. But I miss Jim. I miss Jim, but like everything else, Jim decided he had had enough, and he just checked out and went.
Well, did he pay his bill on his checkout?
No, I don't think so, but I don't think it matters. You know, a well-led life will mean that the last check you write is to the undertucker, and if you've done it right, that sucker will bounce.
His undertucker?
Undertaker.
I'm getting a little, I'm letting it get a little thrill with talking to you, Ray. You know, I'm not my usual self today, I must confess. I've been on a lot of Valium. I've had nervous breakdowns. I've been in the care and treatment. And I got in the veterans hospital, and I'm not even a veteran. But I got
in as a pastor. That's not easy to do.
No, but they put me in because I had done so much good counseling for veterans and convicts and all. I'm a pretty damn good pastor, by the way, folks out there. I'm your FU pastor, George. That stands for
Friendly Unity.
Fed up, but also effed up, if you know what I mean.
No.
You told me not to.
You're getting on the borderline there. Be careful.
All right, borderline. Now, look, I'm not up to my usual quality standard for the radio today. Must admit.
I don't think pastors work with a lot of live microphones in the rooms.
Oh.
I think, generally speaking, their counseling is privacy between them and the person they're talking to.
Well, I'm looking into this mic. It's just one big black ball.
It's right.
And then it's just attractive in a way.
The most important part is not the ball. The ball is just to stop our peas from popping.
Now look, I got, my lawyer, Walter Boyd, is supposed to be here, and I wasn't supposed to do this program today.
I understand.
Oh, here he comes. This is Rayford Parker. You know Rayford?
No.
Well, I just met him.
Now, be careful with Rayford.
I'm not going to be careful. Here he is.
Because I've got a good many years of being recognized as a not very tolerant for racism. So you be careful with Rayford.
Well, you can cut him off or not, but here he is. You want to describe him physically? Or do you want me to?
No, I'll let you do that.
Well, he's a black dude.
Good.
He's one of those agitators. You're going to turn his mic on for him?
It's on.
Well, he's sort of upset, so. Hey, man, this is Rayford Parker, and I'm not going to put up with this stuff from Alabama. You hear me? I'm not going to, you know, Walter Boyd, he claimed to be a liberal lawyer to help us people, but he ain't no, you know, these white judges, they let him in the back room. They don't let me.
Are there any non-white judges in Alabama?
No, I'm not talking. I'm from the Houston area.
Okay.
Rayford Parker's my name.
There are precious few black lawyers in Houston.
I don't know.
We have had some good, great judges that were black in
Houston. Well, all right, but I'm not. I don't like this pastor here. I don't like him. I don't like him one bit. I'm leaving, Ray. I'm not doing no. You're at least gay. You have a little. You have a little empathy for. You know, I learned that.
Well, let me tell you, I have been on so many picket lines for so many years. You have no idea. I was secretary of Houston chapter of NAACP in the late 50s when Dr. King himself came to Houston, and the biggest problem we had is the newspapers and did a complete blackout. The newspapers and the radio shows and the television news did a complete blackout that Dr. King was coming. We had counted on being able to have some news stories to encourage people, both black and white, to turn out to greet Dr. King. But what we got was everybody just said, no, it's news and we'll cover it when it happens. We won't cover it before. So we got blacked out. And so when Dr. King...
Blacked out? Is that what you say? You ain't racist?
We got closed off from radio and television and the newspapers.
Blacked out.
And so, that's the term in the trade you call it.
I think you might be a racist, too, just because you're one of those rich white queers.
Well, I don't know about the rich part, but... when Dr. King came to town, we explained to them that he thought that the response would be less than we had hoped for because we had not received any previous news coverage. And Dr. King said, okay, in Houston, do black people live in contiguous communities? And we said, yes. And he said, well, get a pickup truck and put a hay bale back in the back of the truck and get me a microphone, a sound system, and I'll drive up and down the streets where the black folks live and call them to the meeting. And we said, Dr. King, that will happen, but you are not the person that will do that. And so a bunch of mostly pastors got together, and they went out. They had already been preaching from their pulpits, but they got out and they got pickup trucks with rudimentary sound systems, and they drove up and down the streets in Sunnyside and Fourth Ward and Third Ward and Pleasantville, and they asked people to come hear Dr. King speak. And we had a pretty good crowd. It wasn't as big as it could have been had we had the cooperation of the media. And of course, after the event happened, the media covered it very well. And as far as you could see from just reading what they printed and what they said on television, it wasn't negative. As a matter of fact, Dr. King's coming to Houston was the introduction of a new reporter at Channel 2, a fellow by the name of Napoleon Johnson. And that was his first big story as a reporter for a major network. And he went on to be a reporter for major network television stations. For most of his career, he's teaching journalism out at Texas Southern University now.
Well, hi, Ray. I'm Walter Boyd, the pastor. He had to go out and
he was getting a little nervous.
Yeah, and Rayford.
Take care of Rayford.
Rayford, you put him to sleep with your monologue because yeah. He doesn't care about Dr. King. He's a new generation. He doesn't even know. He's ticked off. He wants you to
something in race. You know, Walter. If I were a young black man.
Yeah. Yeah.
I could justify some being ticked off.
Yeah, well, now, I'm gonna speak just for myself as Walter Boyd.
Okay.
Did my pastor introduce, say anything about me?
He said your name several times.
Okay, well, good. I say good, but it sounds so good to me.
Yeah, I understand.
Almost as good as Ray Hill. But as a black guy, what are you ticked off about? I mean,
well, if I were a black guy, fortunately, I am not a black guy. And I say fortunately, not because I have anything against black guys. I just, I get up with enough problems that I don't need additional problems. And if you get up one morning and you go to the mirror and you're a black person, suddenly, you're going to experience a lot of problems that day that other people do not experience.
Well, maybe the blacks ought to just get an appreciation for this country and what it's done for. This business has taken the knee.
Well, by the same token, this country ought to express some appreciation for what black people have done to help this country.
What have black people done to help this country?
Well,
in
the wars where they were segregated and diminished, they served admirably and with great courage and great cost. That goes back to the Civil War. It was hard for black people to serve.
All right, they
in
served
the Civil
in,
War.
They served in wars.
And
what else?
And they
what
showed else? Bravery what? And courage
well, okay.
that was beyond the expectation of other soldiers.
Is
at
that any
time.
Excuse for them to be? You know, we've had so many black riots, and we just tolerate them one after another. And they attack Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee fought an honorable war. when he quit, when he gave up, surrendered, he went to trying to heal this country. All Rodney Ellis is doing.
Well,
is
I suppose trying, Robert. You know, I suppose Ellis, Rodley. I suppose Robert E. Lee healed this country as much as the commander of West Point could.
Well,
that was his job.
Tried to bring it together, but look at what.
Well, if you're sitting as commander of West Point, and West Point at that time itself was segregated, how much healing do you bring?
Well, I've asked you, Ray. You're not a black guy,
No, but Walter, I will never.
But you've promoted, you have supported the black people about as well as any white dude I know. I know that you've gotten on Pastor George and me occasionally for going up the line and being toward the line of racism. Now, I'm going to plead guilty to that.
Okay. Well, let me tell
but you. But I want to know. I ask you one thing.
Don't be beating on table.
What is black culture done for this country?
Well, I mean, half of our
Music?
At least half of our music. The whole concept of the blues and jazz is basically a black phenomenon.
All right,
occasionally,
music.
Occasionally some white dude will come along and do that. But the blues and the jazz, which is the only Native American form of music.
So there's been a little music. What are they?
Well, wait a minute. You don't palm that off too lightly. I'm not going to let you get away with that, because one of the aspects of American culture that reflects who and what we are and what our goals and aspirations are is the music that is written and performed, not just for our entertainment, but for our general uplifting.
You remember a little bit ago when Trump mentioned that this country produced a symphony, and they jumped all over that, the left wing, and said, my God, that's racist because blacks don't contribute anything to symphonies. Symphonies are a white thing. Western symphonies. You know what I'm talking about, a symphony.
Sure. Well, if you don't think that's true,
what?
That blacks contribute to symphonies.
Then
where does Porgy and Bess come from?
Well,
and where does
well, I'm talking about the reaction.
In the field of music, with classical backgrounds, there is Mississippi Basin music of all kinds, jazz, classical, orchestral. All of that has black roots.
Well, I like Hispanic music myself, so I like the mariachis.
Okay, well, you can go marry any achi you want to, but
look, I'm not gonna marry anybody, man, especially a woman. And women have caused more trouble. I want you to ask you, what have women done? Now, I will say this, that I was a lawyer for quite a while, and I, back here 50 years ago, when I went to my 50th anniversary for being a lawyer for 50 years at the Country Club, we were all white men, and there were some women, but they weren't there. That was the University of Houston Law School. There weren't any women in there. There was one woman, Judge Sondock. I don't know who was in the class, but she wasn't there.
Well, you even wrote a play about Judge Keegan.
Oh, yeah, Judge Keegan. Well, Judge Keegan was...
one of the guys.
Yeah, one of the guys. I did write some about that. But, you know, white women have done very well in this country, especially in the law. They're over half the lawyers now are women. Mm-hmm. Women are smarter than men in the law. If you look at the law schools, women will be at the top of the law school grades, and they have just come in with a flurry. They've come banging into the dadgum profession and done pretty well. Now, you know, when I made that speech out there that Jim Skelton said was the worst thing, when I went out to University of Houston to his class one time, and I said, don't put women on juries. If you're going to strike, use your 10 peremptory strikes in a felony case. First of all, to strike anybody that's connected with police, if you're representing the usual defendant in a criminal case. But then go straight and strike these women, because women are mean as heck. And most of these defendants are
Can you generalize like that one?
I said women are mean as heck. Yes, I can. Women are meaner than men. They're smarter than men. Now, Jim Skelton spread the word that I had said they're not smart enough to serve on jury. I didn't say that at all. I said I realize how smart they are. And when you're mean and smart, you're a very dangerous individual. And that's what
when you're anything and smart, you're upgraded from.
Well, I still say that, and I'm going to stick to it. You can see throughout how women have just, look at what they're doing to men now. Look at all these women coming out of the woodwork and counterpunching. Years later, when they get some money, they don't complain at the time. They come with a vengeance, and then they bring down men. And they're not going to bring me down, Ray, because I'm not worth bringing down. But I tell you what.
Well, you know, that says a lot, Walter, actually.
Well, it's true. They only want to bring down.
No, today is it's kind of an important day in my history, actually. On this date, in 1969, I got up in a nice Washington, D.C. hotel and opened up my hotel room door, and there lay a Washington Post in front of my door. The hotels, better hotels, put out the daily newspaper for all of their guests to find at their front door when they woke up in the morning. And I took the paper in, and I made me some instant coffee. You didn't have those percolating machines, but you did have instant coffee. You get hot water and make coffee. Made some instant coffee. This is 69. Things have changed. And I sat down at the table there because it was a nice room. It had a bed and some chairs and a table where you sit down. And I unfolded the paper, and at the top of the first page, it said, "This looks like Moscow 1917. And it was a quote by the Attorney General of the United States, a fellow by the name of John Mitchell. And what I was doing in Washington is I was chair of the Student Mobilization Committee to end the war in Vietnam. And that was part of a coalition called the Moratorium March Coalition. So I was on the executive committee of that march, and on the podium, I was up there with Arlo Guthrie and Peter Paul and Mary and the cast of Laugh In. We had some wonderful people on the stage to entertain, and a lot of great speakers to talk about ending the war and hopefully living in peace. And I led that march for my organization. And it was 1969, where young men in colleges, they would put 12 young, hunky, big men in a single microbus, college students, and drive through 4 foot of snow to get to Washington, D.C. to march against that war. And they would make no reservations, had no plans, just they would come. And we would get cooperating churches to let us file them like library cards between the pews of the church. And the next morning, 750 people would wake up and get up and all share the same bathroom before going out on the streets to holler and yell. It was cool. It was clear. A little damp at night. Later that day, I would lead a march of wounded veterans. Some on wheelchairs, some on crutches, some on walkers. Across a bridge and over to the back wall of the White House compound. And watch them throw their medals, some Purple Hearts, the medals they had received. They threw them over onto the lawn of the White House. And these are the already wounded. These are not the kids that haven't been called up in the draft. These are those that had been to Vietnam and objected to the war. And thank God for the old lefties, I mean the wobblies, I mean there were still wobblies in those days, because they knew to, when the tear gas came, to run into the bars and grab a fistful of napkins and soak them in the water and go out and give them to the kids so they could breathe cleaner air through a wet napkin than they could.
Did you
remember that?
Yeah. Did you see John Kerry throw his over?
No, I didn't. John Kerry didn't exist for me then. He was still in the military then. It's 1969.
Yeah, he came later.
Yeah, he would come later.
He came later.
The deal is that I experienced all of that, and that was kind of a rush. I mean, and then exactly a year later, let's move to November of 1970. I hit Texas prison, sentenced to 160 years. And when I finally got to the Ramsey unit, the unit where I would live for many years, I got off the chain bus. And when I finally got into the compound where I was going to live, got to a cell block that I was going to live in as an inmate, I went in there. Bless you. I went in there. And there on the domino table at the head of that was a Life magazine. Remember Life magazines?
Oh, yeah.
And it was open on a two-page spread picture, and there I was, a picture of me.
No, really, you weren't Life?
At the march the year before.
I'll be doggone. Now, that's not the pro-life. That was Life.
No, just Life.
Yeah, people out there don't know.
Yeah, well, Life magazine, was big business in those days.
Yeah, it was a big one.
They were a photograph magazine. I mean, told all of the news in photographs.
Yeah, they did. And in 69, you were in Washington.
In 70, I was in
prison. In 70, in prison. Well, you came back and did some burglaries real fast.
I had been doing burglaries all along.
Yeah.
That's how I paid for my trip to Washington, I pulled a big heist, a jewel heist, and got a bunch of money.
that's wonderful. I have a girlfriend.
I don't think the people that I heisted thought it was so wonderful until they got the insurance check, and then they forgot all about the burglary.
Yeah. Well, I like those big burglary rings myself. I would be capable of any kind of bank robbery, for instance.
Don't get into the robbery business, because number one, you've got to use what I call tortured metal. You know what you've got to do to metal to make a gun? You've got to be mean to metal to make enough hard metal for a barrel.
I would commit a crime we all probably would commit murder if it was legal.
I don't think I would commit it, but I do have a list of names of people that I will read their obituary with more pleasure than others.
Well, I would kill some people who are already dead, just kill them again. But getting back, there's a movie out that I saw about this Vietnam experience, and it's really, it doesn't involve Vietnam, but it involves Afghanistan, and it's Thank You for Your Service.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard about that one? I think it's not as Afghanistan, it's Iraq.
It got good reviews.
It's pretty good, and it's got some good twists, but it shows you, Ray, why veterans might be prone to commit suicide. more than others. But it may be a stretch. I've always discounted these stories about veterans coming back from war experience and then having all these memories prop up, and they scream at the, and their wife is sitting in lying in bed, and they're screaming that she, they're thinking she's attacking him and so forth. I've thought that is a bunch of hokey, but this movie sort of disillusions me.
Well, have you ever, I mean, you didn't do service, but I didn't do service, but I was a journalist. I went to Vietnam for 3 months.
Yeah, I know you did.
In 1960, 3 months. That's no time at all. Well, 3 months at all time. And I was dutifully armed with a pencil and a spiral notebook to make notes. I was there to write, and I went over there. But when the rounds start coming in, people start shooting at you and the people you're with, you're going to mess up your underwear whether you've got a combatant or whether you're there to fight anyway.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry I wasn't a veteran. I didn't avoid it. I tried to get in, and I really, I'm such a cookie cutter.
Tell me about that, because I never wanted to be a soldier. I didn't mind being a journalist. Of course, my idea is that a journalist is going to go over there and both sides are going to agree where you sit comfortably and cover their war.
Some of these journalists are very courageous. Geraldo Rivera is one of them, I believe, who's really been in treacherous circumstances. My brother went over to Vietnam, not as a Marine, which he was, but they had lost track of him. He went over there and became with Brown and Root.
He was contractor.
He was the personnel director, so he could hire people. But he experienced those same things over there, the traumas. But I just wonder if when I went down the draft board, I was drafted when I was in law school, but I didn't have a deferment, so went down there and I just acted my usual stupid self, which I've been, and I according reaching over and trying to kiss the sergeant on the forehead, just cutting up. Do you know what they did to me down there?
No.
The draft board. They got me so naked. They put me on a gurney and pushed the gurney out in the middle of a bank lobby, and I was sitting there and people coming. That's what they did to humiliate me, because I had acted up. Then they send me the psychiatrist, and he interviews me. He says, I'm gonna recommend that they don't accept you. We don't need any people like you. You're too nutty. Well, you know, as nutty as I've been in my life, it's terrible.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
There's another movie I want to recommend to you, Ray. You go to River Oaks 3.
Sometimes.
Well, there's a Catholic movie over there. It shows the effect of Vatican II on nuns. But it's got universal themes. It shows, because when these nuns, when Vatican II opened it up and took away the meaning of life for these nuns, it took away their reason for living. And it's just amazing, but it shows you when you remove the structure that people are used to from their life, people live by structure. Religion gives them structure, and they may or not buy into it. But it's a good movie on how that affected. And they say 90,000 nuns. Now the proscript said 90,000 nuns quit their nunnery as a result of Vatican II. Now I don't know. But it's a first-time filmmaker. She wrote and directed this, and I recommend that. And I'm going down to River Oaks 3 today while I'm in town and going to see another one down there, because everything in River Oaks 3 is good. Now, would you pass the word on and get me a free ticket for the publicity
I got? I used to have connections there, but they've been long gone. Gish, a friend of mine, used to run that place, and I couldn't.
Yeah.
I could call Sarah and get tickets, but
no,
I can't do that anymore.
No, don't worry about it. I can.
What is your favorite movie? You've seen a lot of movies in your life.
Well, I don't know if my favorite one, but because it's, I don't watch anymore, I can't. But I'd say there's 1939. It didn't win the Academy Award. You know what it was? The what do they call the Civil War movie?
Which Civil War? Gone with the Wind?
Gone with the Wind. I think there was
Gone with the Wind.
Such a wonderful.
I've seen Gone with the Wind some 10 times.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, whenever I was just a kid, my mother held me by the hand as we got into a long line all the way around the block in downtown Houston to go see Gone with the Wind. And
it did win Academy Award that year, I believe.
Well, it won several Academy Awards. Selznick did very well from that. It was the most successful movie for another 40 years. But
it's described as racist now because it gives a good view of the way white slave owners treated the blacks, and that's not the way they want it to be portrayed today. And it's just a great movie I don't know if it's my favorite, because I cannot, Ray, see a Vietnam movie or a movie about the Civil War. That was the most tragic war for Americans to be killing Americans because Abraham Lincoln got on his high horse.
Well, what do you think about Burns' work in that regard? Burns' Civil War is goes on and on, and it's like wiping your ass with a railroad track. There's just no end to it.
I have a hard time watching that. It's just awful to see so much carnage
and Burns' recent work on Vietnam.
Yeah.
And I was alive and well and politically active, and I learned things watching that about the war that had escaped my knowledge and judgment.
Well, I just cannot imagine that we reenact these battle scenes. Can you imagine how awful it was for 600,000 or 800,000 Americans to lose their lives? Those were just combatants.
Yeah.
It was terrible, and Vietnam is something that to see what our country did to those poor veterans, to send even McCain over there to fly a plane over there and have him shot down, and others, to see those people being taken in by the North Vietnam and mistreated as prisoners and so forth. I just don't know how in the world we get to a point where we sacrifice people like that, where we put people into war. And Abraham Lincoln, in my opinion, is most overrated. If he had lost that war, he'd have gone down as the worst president. And he should never have been honored to be a great president. Now, that's just my view. But I don't understand. Of course, you know what it is. It's a will to power, Nietzsche. Abraham Lincoln had a will to power just like the rest. He couldn't stand to lose power over these states that were leaving. That's all it was. It wasn't a fight for the Union as such, or even for slavery, against slavery. It was just a desire, a craving to maintain as much power as you can in your life. And that's the real problem with people. You know Nietzsche pretty good. Nietzsche?
Well, I kind of understand some of Nietzsche's theories about the attraction of power. But when I read Nietzsche and I try to apply them to people like Trump, if Trump really wants to hang on to power, he's certainly not very good with his Nietzsche, because everything he does is counter to his holding power.
But it's your perception when you're acting. See, you know how nutty I am, over the top. Donald Trump is over the top because, in my opinion, psychologically, he's insecure. He's a great success, but he has to go over the top because to be in the middle and to do things right takes a great deal of study, attention, focus, and patience. Mm-hmm. And some don't have it, and so goes over the top. That attracts attention. That impels him more to go over the top. That's the way it is with me. If people respond to me going over the top, I'm going to go over the top even more. But there is going over the top in being gracious and being a being and doing it as a show and not a force, not going over the top to hurt people, but to just simply attract attention to yourself so you can help people. See, that's my deal. And I think Trump, you have a different view of Trump, but I think Trump really has a love for this country that Obama never did.
You really believe that?
I do believe it. I think Obama disliked this
country.
Well,
then that depends upon your and his definition of country.
Well, I agree. It does depend.
Because I don't see anything that Trump does that shows any commitments to the principles outlined in the Constitution. He is certainly not a constitutionalist.
Well, he may not, but he loves this country. Obama disliked this
country.
Well,
I don't know. I can fall in love with a complete stranger walking down the block.
Well, it's,
but unless I know something about them, that's not very productive.
Well, you're right, but it may be ineffective. But I think there's a heart.
I think Donald Trump does not have enough basic understanding of what this country is about.
Yeah, Obama didn't have it, and he didn't
no.
care because he
Obama had a constitutional understanding. He had taught constitutional law and engaged in debates about constitutional law, and had that down. I mean, you don't become the editor of the Harvard Review without having a good legal education.
Yeah, I guess so, but I don't think he had such a bias against this country. You remember his apology
I didn't see
tours?
That. No, I don't remember any. I remember what were characterized. I remember what he characterized as his apology tours. And yes, I agreed with him on apologizing by the racist nature of American society, which had been given a free rein for too long. I absolutely agreed with that. I thought he needed to bring that up, point it out, and say we're going to do better in the future. That was absolutely necessary. But when it came to the Constitution of the United States is about structure. The basis of the Constitution of the United States is about structure. How is this country organized, and under what are the rules and the regulations does it operate? And Obama has an understanding of that. Trump has never read that stuff. Trump is about greed and selfishness. He has not read any constitutional dialogue. You could take Trump and drop in the middle of a classic Greek dialogue discussing the Constitution of the United States, and he would be a fish out of water. Obama, on the other hand, understood the Constitution, taught the Constitution of the United States, and followed it to a letter.
Well, I don't think so, Ray, because just go right through Obama's career. I started figuring Obama out pretty early on. I was for Obama versus Hillary down in 2008.
Yeah, but you're anti-women, so that
doesn't
count to
anything. Well, that, you might say that.
That's
but
true.
I'm also,
you're sexist.
I don't like women very much.
But I noticed.
But I do think a woman should be president of the United States.
I think we need one. But I also think we needed a black one. One of my favorite friends said, when Obama, it was at Obama and Hillary, why can't he wait his turn? I said, hon, black people have been waiting their turn a long time.
Well, maybe they can wait their turn and then appreciate what this country's done for.
Well, if anybody appreciate what this country was about, it was Barack Hussein Obama. He was a constitutionalist.
Well, you keep saying that, and I'm not sure we got into details one way or another.
Okay,
that.
Walter, I've got a few seconds. I hope you can
wrap it up.
I want to thank you all for listening. And actually, my discussion with Walter got down to some pretty good stuff the last few minutes. Those are the kinds of discussions I want to have on Ray on the Radio. You can participate by calling next week. I'm going to go away, and I will be back next Wednesday. That's all right. I'll fix that. I'll be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. Meanwhile, this is Ray Hill from Ray on the Radio. On behalf of Houston Media Source, wishing you a good rest of the afternoon and a wonderful week, and I'll see you here, same station, same bat channel, next Wednesday on Houston Media Source.